I think the most important thing is to practice before you get into the interview situation. Because if you're meeting someone for the first time, you want to feel comfortable and you want to make them feel comfortable. Because I think that's the first thing you've got to concentrate on. Because you might have someone who's not used to being interviewed, who's feeling a bit nervous, is meeting you for the first time, perhaps in an unfamiliar location. So you have to be sufficiently comfortable with the technology so you don't really have to worry about it, and you can concentrate your attention on the person and getting them into a good position for giving the kind of interview that you want. Therefore, you have to feel entirely comfortable with the technology, and I'm afraid that probably just means practice. It just means getting out at home, interviewing members of your family, testing the levels, just making sure you know where you plug things in. I mean, I have gone to interviews and plugged the microphone into the headphone socket and thought, why is it not working? And then you sort of begin to panic. You think something's gone terribly wrong, and then you realise you've simply put something in the wrong socket. So it has to kind of become second nature so that you can be unpacking your bag as you're chatting to somebody and getting them in the right frame of mind for the interview. So I think simply practice. Sitting down with the... And I know everybody hates sitting down with the instruction book. I hate it too. And often you can write things out just by experimentation, but I think you do need to put in a bit of time just to feel at ease. Otherwise, you will get into the situation where you're becoming anxious and your interviewee becomes anxious. I'd say before you come out, check your bag. Check you've got everything. You can either have a mental checklist, or even better, you can have a physical checklist and just go through it. And don't go through it just once, go through it twice, because the worst thing is to get to an interview and discover you've run out of batteries. You forgot to change them at the end of the last interview. You forgot to pack a spare. And there's nothing that looks more unprofessional than saying, I have no power to record this interview. So make sure you've got all the kit that you need. Then you just plug it in. You get the microphone, you get your cable, you plug it into your recorder and getting your headphones ready. And then you're monitoring the sound. I mean, I think the other thing to say is when you arrive at a location, you're trying to find the best place to make the recording, where you're least likely to have extraneous sound that you don't want in the recording coming in. So, and I failed to do that. I came in and I sat down and I was waiting for you, but I hadn't seen there was actually a lower level, which was actually a much better area. So, I'm guilty of not checking out the location fully. But then you do a bit of a sound test, which also helps to make the interviewee feel more relaxed. You just get them to chat about something innocuous, and while you're doing that, you're listening to what kind of level you're getting from them, and also any other extraneous sound that might be a problem. The tripod, first of all, enables you to see the display clearly, so you know you can see the level of your recording to make sure it's not peaking, and you can see how much time has elapsed. So if you go into another thing to say is, before you go into an interview, have an idea about roughly how much material you want. You know, maybe you've been commissioned to produce the material, or maybe it's for your own purposes, it's training purposes, or for your own blog. But have an idea of what you want to end up with. And you may record significantly more, you may record more or less exactly the number of minutes you want, but know what you aim to end up with. So that's why we put it on the tripod. External mic is much more directable, whereas if you've got an inbuilt mic, you're going to get less good quality, and B, it's less easy to direct it at the sound source. And C, the headphones give you the monitoring capacity. You actually know what's going into the machine. So if this, for example, you might pick up the sound of an aircraft and you would hear that clearly on the headphones in a way that you might not so immediately hear it on live. Therefore, you can say to the interview, let's just pause a minute and we'll take that back because we've got an airplane coming over. So it allows you to actually hear what you're recording. I've tried using over-the-ear headphones, and I've tried using noise-excluding headphones, which is a very strange experience, and I think not to be recommended. It creates a strange bubble around you. So I like ones which are open enough so you feel you're actually present, but you're also hearing what's going into the recorder. But that may be a matter of personal preference. The worst thing you can do is to come in and start fiddling with your kit, and they're just sitting there getting nervous and thinking, you know, when is this going to start, and what's he doing, and why is this all taking so long? So you want to try to, you know, maintain eye contact with them and be almost doing the kit automatically. And then you get to a point where you just have to focus on that and get the sound, and you can explain to them what you're doing. And then you get underway. I started out, it's nearly 10 years ago now, and in those days, a mini disc recorder was the best, easily affordable medium to record on. And that's what I started with. But then about 5 years ago, I got some advice which was invaluable from somebody who worked as a BBC producer, and I asked him what I should buy, basically to set up and become more professional about what I was doing. And he recommended a machine made by Marantz, the 660. So I acquired one of those. And he recommended an Audio-Technica microphone, which I'm still using, and I'm still using the Marantz. Since those days, Marantz have produced a new machine, a 661, which is just smaller, more portable. You can mount it on a tripod or on top of a camera. So I haven't made that my regular machine yet, just because what we were saying earlier about sort of familiarity, I just want a bit more time to get used to using that machine. But that's going to be my main machine. If you're doing it seriously, it's not a bad idea to have a backup machine. Now, in most day-to-day circumstances, that's probably overkill. But if I'm going out to do an interview with a visiting author who's only in the country for 2 days, I don't want something to go wrong. You know, there might just be something that goes wrong, maybe the memory card or something, some foul-up. So I will always take a backup machine. And the one I'm using as backup now, the one which we're recording this on, is one which I would recommend for people starting out. It's affordable. I think it's less than £200. And it's made by Sony. And it's called, I think, the PCM M10. And it's the little brother of the Sony sort of flagship portable digital recorder, which is about £2,000. And so they've stripped that down. It's not the same machine, but it does a very decent job. It's got decent inbuilt mics. It can take external mics. It's got astonishing battery life. That's one of the things I discover in this business, is that you get through a hell of a lot of batteries, and this machine, the batteries will last for a very long time. You can put in micro SD cards, which will give you 8 hours recording, as well as the inbuilt memory. So it's got a long memory, it's got excellent battery life, it's extremely portable, and for the price, I think it's got a very good sound quality. I think it would be wrong to fetishize the kit, although there's always, you know, I'm as susceptible as the next person to cruising the internet late at night looking for glitzy new recording devices. I think it doesn't matter as much as other factors. I think the most important thing is the one we talked about at the beginning, making the interviewee feel comfortable so that they give you their best, because ultimately you want the content, and obviously you want to achieve a basic level of competence in the actual recording, because no one wants to listen to a recording where the microphone's been very badly placed or the levels are peaking all the time. But really what people want is the content. So I mean, you can test that thesis to destruction by using very low grade recorders, and I have used a very small Sony recorder which records only an MP3, and it's about the size of two small boxes of matches. It's the most portable thing you can possibly imagine. And the sound quality, frankly, isn't really very great. And I put out one podcast using that, and I wasn't at all happy with the result. So you do, as so often, get what you pay for, but a reasonably good recorder in the right hands, handled correctly, can probably produce a better result than a very expensive recorder, which is being used badly. And if you listen to podcasts online, you often think, well, why didn't they just handle the microphone a bit better or avoid making some fairly obvious mistakes? The microphone that I'm using is about £100. And again, you can probably get a microphone for between 75 to the sky's your limit, really. But I'd have thought for a decent entry-level microphone in the region of £100 would be fine. The recorder, yes, you can probably get a serviceable, a decent recorder for not much more than £100, I would have thought. And the more professional ones are £400, £500, £600. So it's quite a good range. And also look on eBay. I mean, my most recent recorder was bought on eBay at a very decent price. The software can range from free, as we said, to a few hundred dollars. Then there are consumables like headphones. Again, I think you could probably use your earbuds that you use with your iPod, or you could splash out and spend a bit more. But the ones that you're using, which are mine, I think only cost about £30, and I think they've got the great advantage of portability. And that's the other thing. I often travel to interviews on my bicycle, so I don't want a lot of heavy kit. So there's a consideration there. What will fold up and be easiest to transport? So the consumables, you get through a lot of batteries, memory cards, you have to have spares. But I'd have thought you could get set up with a decent sort of rig, with a decent external microphone and all the peripherals for in the region of £200 to £300. I think the first thing I would say is it's very important to be prepared, to know what you want. And as I said earlier, that may be because a client has been explicit about what they want, or they've given you a brief which is rather vague, which you've had to think through for yourself, or maybe you're doing it for yourself. But whatever the circumstance, you must think beforehand, what do I actually want to achieve? And then what do I need to know in order to achieve that in terms of background knowledge and preparation? Now, I'm working for the vast majority of my time with authors of books, which is a great advantage in many ways, because you've got their sort of statement on paper, so you can read that in preparation. And also, they tend to be articulate people. So, and often they've had experience of being interviewed. So, I start with several advantages. So, if you're going into a different situation, you may have to work differently and maybe a bit harder in order to elicit from the interviewee what you want to achieve. But what I would typically do is spend time looking at the interviewee's published work. I look at online profiles, I might look at a blog or a website if they've got it, taking notes on that. And then what I'll do is I'll boil it down, and I'll typically go into an interview situation with an index card on which I've written prompts to me. It might be little facts like a date or a name, because you don't want to get into an interview and sort of say and as your character, and then freeze because you can't remember the name of the character. And under pressure, it's amazing how elusive names can sometimes be, or dates. You think you know it, and then in the tips you think, was it 1836 or was it 1838? So you don't want to have to sort of slow the interview down by sort of saying, I've got to check. So I always have something at hand which I can quickly glance at. So I'm not sort of sitting there reading the questions in a sort of pre-programmed way, but I have an idea of how the ideal interview might go. But I'm flexible enough to go from that in the process. So my index card is a sort of aide-memoire, it's a sort of comfort blanket. Sometimes I won't have to glance at it at all, but if it weren't there, I think I'd feel anxiety. But going back to your question, how do you put your interviewee at ease? I think by tuning into their wavelength, by being clear about what you want to get out of it. So I always remind them, because they may have been doing several interviews, so I remind them who it's for, what the purpose is, how long we're going to talk for. I tell them that I'm going to edit it, which makes them relax, because they think if I fluff something, then it'll be taken out, so I won't look silly. I give them some idea of how elaborate I want their answers to be, whether I want them to be kind of quite quick and precise, or whether I'm inviting them to talk at greater length. And really, as you did this morning, once you're underway for a little bit, it's quite useful to reassure them, to say this is great, this is what I was wanting. And then they think they can sort of settle into it. And obviously don't start out with your killer question, the big question. Start out quite gently with questions which will get them to relax and open up and make them think, yes, I can do this. This is going well. And then you can get into tougher questions as you go along. I mean, not the tough in the sense of, you know, hostile, but tough, and ones that maybe require them to work a bit harder, to think a bit harder about the answers they're giving. We're recording in WAV format at the moment, so it's uncompressed sound. So these are big files, and the recorder connects to the laptop with the cable which will come with the recorder, so it's very quick to transfer the files. I always retain the files on the recorder till the editing process is completely finished, and I'm sure that I have no further need of it, just in case something goes wrong in the transfer. I have been using Sony SoundForge for a long time as my main editing suite. It offers a lot of options. It's quick, it's flexible, and I've grown used to it. I've also been experimenting on the Mac with Amadeus, which is also it's lighter, it's slimmer. There are fewer plugins and effects and so on. But I suppose one of my points would be that you don't necessarily have to get hung up on all the effects that the processing tools that you may get with a more sophisticated program. Because all editing programs, you know, from Audacity, which is free, up to ones which cost several hundred dollars, allow you to form the same basic kind of edits. I will go through the file and put in markers so that I've got some idea of the shape of the thing. Because when you're recording it, you don't always necessarily retain that overview of the entire interview. So I'll go through, I'll put in a marker for my question, I'll put in a marker for the response. So that gives you a sort of basic shape of it, and you can sort of then see, if you recorded 30 minutes and you want to get it down to 20 minutes, you can see the sort of relative size of the parts, and you're listening to that, to the overall structure of it as you're doing it. And then I'll start to look for things that I can take out, whether they're ums or ahs or pauses which are too long or repetitions or blind alleys or entire questions where I think maybe I've led the interviewer down a blind alley or they've become slightly, you know, they've gone off the subject, and so that might come out in its entirety. I mean, that process can take several times longer than the interview itself, but again, it's important not to become too fixated on tweaking every tiny detail. You can over-edit, just like you can over-edit anything. You can over-edit a picture, you can over-edit a text file. You can get to the point where you've actually done too much work. You've perhaps tightened something up to the point where it no longer sounds natural. And I think it's always better to leave in those natural human pauses or fluffs rather than create something which sounds unnatural. And there are all sorts of strange little things you can notice in the file. For example, if you're in an acoustic environment which is quite reverberant, you will get echo. Now, if someone goes and then continues what they're saying, you will get the echo of that over the top of what they say next. So the human ear is so attuned that it will not notice that until you take out the And when the comes out, you're left with echo right at the start, and the ear immediately picks up on that. So that'd be an example where I would leave the in, even though it maybe sounds a little bit inelegant, you think someone's hesitated, but if you take it out, you can actually produce something which is more anomalous and sounds unnatural. So I suppose what I'm saying in short is, better have a natural sounding recording which has rough edges than have one which is over tightened and actually draws attention to itself. The other thing is, when you get to the stage of processing the sound, you might do noise reduction, which is a process whereby you sample a piece of an undesirable noise, say a refrigerator or aircraft or air conditioning, and you then get the program to look for that noise profile throughout the entire file and reduce it by a certain amount. That's something which can be very useful, but you've got to use it quite sparingly, because if you are too aggressive in your noise reduction or make too many passes, you can end up with a file which has got artifacts which are only audible when you come to process the final file, when you're going from the uncompressed file to the MP3 file, because I'm imagining that the most frequent form of dissemination is going to be as an MP3 online. And when you do that, obviously you're chucking away a lot of the data, and so those artifacts which may be hidden can be amplified, and I've ended up in the past with files that sound like they were recorded in a tin box underwater, so that the naturalness of the human voice can be eradicated. And I spoke to a BBC producer about this, and he said he tries to do as little of that sort of processing as possible. The lesson, I suppose, is the better your original source file, much in the same way as a photograph, the less editing you have to do, the more likely it is you will end up with a natural sounding result, which is what you're aiming to do. I think video is more a performance. It's more of a whole person performance, and the interviewee is conscious of that too. So they sort of begin fixing their hair or worrying about their makeup. Or I interviewed somebody yesterday who got out his powder and started putting on, because he had a background in TV and he had that at the ready. But people become much more self-conscious. What I tend to do, because I'm looking to produce both audio and video, is I tend to do the audio first, because that establishes a rapport, it gets them to relax, it just lets them sort of run through their material. And also it helps me, because I will go into the video session with a sort of checklist of things I would like to produce, but often in the process of the interview, other things come up and you think, oh, I hadn't thought of that, but that would be great to get the interviewee to do a minute on such and such. So it's a useful process for both of us. And then when it comes to the video, yes, I will brief them on what I want. I'll say we want to keep these to 1 minute, so it's much more soundbitey than the audio. And I will usually go through and say, well, why don't we start with this, and then we can do that and that and that. So they've got in their minds a kind of idea of it. You have to be prepared to do things more than once. In audio, you can kind of patch things, you can edit things, and you don't have to keep getting people to retake. With video, you want, I mean, you, obviously there are ways around it, but you want to try and get a clean take, as clean a take as possible. So maybe you'd get them to do it two or three times. But also you have to know when to stop. Because sometimes people kind of jam on something. They just get stuck. They get a mental block. They keep getting to a certain point and something goes. And at that point, you've got to know when to sort of stop and do something different and say, that's fine, we'll come back to that. Or why don't we talk about this now? And that's often enough just to sort of break that jam. It's horrible watching someone go through the same thing again and again and keep getting stuck. And then they become frustrated and self-conscious and you will cease to get the best out of them. I am quite excited about the possibility of using the latest iPhone for video. Not for professional clients who expect a different kind of product and finish, but for those moments, perhaps at the end of an audio interview, where you don't have time to set up all the kit, or you're not travelling with all the kit, but you just want some kind of video record of the encounter. So I think, because there are often times where you're working against the clock, I find. You've got an interviewee who's just come back from an appointment and they're late and they've got to get off to another appointment. And you've got to decide, is it going to produce the best result to take the time to set up all the kit for the video? Or might a little iPhone video at the end work? So I think that the capacity of the latest iPhone is really impressive. And I think people who simply want to get some content up quickly should probably think very seriously about doing that. But from that point on, I mean, most compact cameras now have the capacity to do video, and very often in HD. What I'm using is a Canon DSLR, which is in a sort of prosumer bracket, because it offers lots of advantages in terms of quality and interchangeable lenses and low light capacity and so on. And I suppose I've invested more than £1,000 in the camera and lens, and then the tripod might be another couple of £100, and then you go through a lot of memory cards with video, because it's a high definition video. It's very memory hungry. But I suppose with the audio, and maybe even more so, the range of possibilities for someone who just wants to experiment and dip a toe in is huge, from their own phone all the way up to, semi-professional level equipment, which will come in at four figures. I think the expectation is of higher quality video than you might get on your phone, say. And that could be, the depth of field you will get with a DSLR, or the ability to work in low light will be much better than with your phone. And I think also, I mean, this may be counterintuitive, but human beings are much more tolerant of slightly iffy quality video pictures than they are of iffy quality sound. And so when I go to do a video, the quality of the sound is at least as important as the quality of the pictures. And so what you can capture on your iPhone won't match that in terms of sound quality. So I'll be using an external sound recorder, and I'll be using a clip-on microphone, so I get a really good quality sound, and then I will be matching up the audio from the camera and the external recorder using a piece of software called Dual Eyes, which does all the synchronization for me. So you've got a good quality image from the camera, and you've got a very good quality sound from the recorder. And I think that, along with the intrinsic quality of the images, sort of sets it apart. But I think also there's a perceptual issue that if you turn up and you're charging money, then you can't really turn up with your iPhone, and it doesn't look very professional. And it's an obvious invitation to the client to say, well, I could do that. Yesterday, I interviewed the author of a book called A Time Traveller's Guide to Elizabethan England. which is a follow-up to his bestseller, A Time Traveller's Guide to Medieval England. The client was Blackwell, and we knew we wanted to produce audio and video. So in terms of preparation, the book is arranged as a guidebook, so it tells you, you know, what to eat, what to wear, where to stay, how to travel, what people thought. So it's presented like a guidebook, but to a different historical period. I probably spent about half a day's preparation time on that, dipping into it, using the index, reading the introduction carefully, the end matter, and then dipping in and selecting pieces which I thought would work well. So that's preparation. So you end up with your list of points you want to cover. Then I went along yesterday and we spent a 90-minute session. And in that time, I recorded about 40 minutes of audio, including a 5-minute reading from the book. And I recorded probably about 15 minutes of video. The editing time on that, I'd have thought about a day to do it all. Probably half a day on the audio and half a day on the video. That's working quite quickly. Because, I mean, just think about a 40-minute file, just even to listen to it in real time takes 40 minutes. So when you begin to stop and go back and compare, and you can easily spend, you know, 3 hours on editing something like that. The video, the lots of separate clips and some retakes, I'll be reviewing those and working out, because they're more like a pack that can be shuffled, whereas the audio is more a consecutive interview. With the video, I'll be working out what sequence, which ones drop, whether I want to use any additional additional visuals in it. So again, it could quite easily take half a day to do that and just make all the technical tweaks and serve the files up in the final form. Total project time, probably about 2 days.
What extra visuals might you use for an author video?
If I can find copyright-free images on Wikicommons, I might drop in, you know, if he's talking about torture implements, I might find a historical document showing a torture implement while he's talking about it. Or if he's talking about a castle, I might find an image of the castle and just cut away to that. It really mainly works for non-fiction. I did a video recently about a historical novel, and it was possible. It was about a Polish ghetto. I found a map of the ghetto online, and I found historical pictures of the ghetto. So it can sometimes work, but it's easier with non-fiction than fiction.